Minority thing, right?
graduation, yeah.
Which is like whatever. But the main question I think that comes up, and I talk to my students about this, is that if we're all going to be minorities, then how do we form a new majority? And this is where I think culture is crucial, to be able to instill these new values for a culture that pushes towards racial justice and social justice.
Excerpt from Uprising Radio. You can find it just like that on the web.org. And she's got a YouTube channel, Sonali Kalhatar, the host. The guest there was Who We Be, The Colorization of America. The interview's nearly an hour and does have a lot of insights. And I like the one that we ended on there. Thanks for listening. Opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. And it's time for the Labor Hour. And Sundiata Chajwa is on today. And that's really fortuitous, it seems to me. Stay tuned.
We're just not working.
folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air of listener-supported community radio station WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. Views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. And Bill Gorell is right now getting out the underwriting book, but I want to tell you that we've got a very interesting show. And I guess before Bill does the underwriting announcements, I'll just go ahead and introduce our special guest, Professor Chajua from the University of Illinois African American Studies Department. Welcome to the World Labor Hour, Professor.
Oh, glad to be here, David.
Okay. And anyway.
Please call me Sundiata.
Sundiata, okay. But anyway, Bill's getting ready here for the underwriting announcements, which are no big deal. And we're going to continue our discussion from last week with Gus Wood, who happens to be the graduate student of Sundiata's. And we're going to continue this discussion of African American labor history. That we were talking about last week, basically from the origins of the United States at Jamestown up until Reconstruction. And so we're thinking about maybe picking up at Reconstruction and moving on into the 20th century here.
Dave.
So anyway.
Good. Dave, I would like for you to use that as a music bed while I am reading the announcements.
Okay.
I know it's tricky.
Yeah, well, if you'd have let me know in advance, I could have been all prepped, but that's okay. We do these things sometimes here on the air, don't we? Okay.
All right. Just fade it up a little bit. There we go. This is a song is Sexual Harassment in the Workplace by Frank Zappa. This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs and Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs and Justice holds their regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at the Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon in Urbana. And that would be like a block west of the Canopy Club. Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners at WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. And the Graduate Employees Organization Union, or the GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but to also give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio, and I'm proud to wear this shirt that says GEO on the front of it.
Yes. It is a union to be proud of, that's for sure, in this community. So, okay, Bill.
Yeah, next time we have them come on, they need to bring T-shirts for us.
Yeah, too. Okay. All right, so we're going to start some news stories here. I'm going to work internationally and then work down to the local here. Uruguayan presidential candidate and former president Tabaré Vázquez is heading to a comfortable victory against his opponent, Luis Lacalle, in Sunday's runoff, so the new polls published Wednesday in Uruguay. According to pollster Equipos Consultores, Vázquez, who is candidate of the left-wing coalition Broad Front, would get around 54.5% of the vote, while Lacalle, who runs as a candidate of the Conservative National Front, would only get about 40%. Okay, and the, I guess the Uruguayans will head to the polls tomorrow for the second round of voting, and Tabaré Vázquez received the most votes in the first round with 47.8% of the votes. Vázquez's left-wing coalition party, the Broad Front, has recently already won a majority of seats in Uruguay's Congress, and it's a very, I guess, a very popular government. When it was first elected to office, they basically really improved the economy and have really decreased poverty and a lot fewer homeless people, and also legalized marijuana, interestingly enough.
And also, their president, whose name I forget, is known as the poorest president in the world.
Really?
Okay. Yeah, he lives like on a like a small farm and drives his own kind of cheap car, and he basically lives what we might not say think of as sort of a middle income level. You know, no big Secret Service entourage. I guess because maybe people like him, so they won't kill him.
Whatever, yeah, I guess. That's kind of interesting, though. Okay, on Thursday and Friday, Los Angeles and Long Beach port truck drivers, supported by the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, ended 8 days of strikes against five employers who have now agreed to meet with union officials. The primary concern of the drivers and their misclassification by employers as independent contractors. They're not independent contractors. Most of them, they lease a truck from the employer. They have no independence at all. They can't drive the truck for any other customers. All their terms and conditions of employment is what they're paid. They have no say in the hours they work, the loads they pull. That's all determined for them by the employers. They pay all the costs of operating the business. They pay all the fuel, all the tolls, all the repairs to the trucks. The fact of the matter is they have a number of these drivers who work a 50, 60 or more hour week and end up with a negative paycheck. At the request of Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti, the workers and the companies returned to the table for discussions. The Teamsters Justice for Port Truck Drivers campaign characterized as productive. Potter says as long as their meetings remain productive, the drivers will continue to work. And Potter said if those talks break down, we're going to use whatever lawful economic means we can use, including the right to go on strike.
Yeah, and what people need to remember, too, is that actually, since these people are considered independent contractors, I believe they even have their own trucks.
Yes.
Okay, but they're dispatched by this company. Then they're considered them joining together as it's illegal for them to have a union because that would be a antitrust kind of situation. You see,
Boy,
back in the past, historically, that was a situation even with salaried employees up until when the late 1900s or was actually National Labor Relations Act or.
Yeah, there were some other rulings on it before then, but you know, the National Relations Act did kind of solidify it a lot more. But there were problems. You're right.
Illegal combine.
Yes.
There we go.
Okay, thousands of University of California students across the state walked out of their classrooms Monday to protest steep tuition hikes they say will cripple their access to education. Students staged walkouts at more than 10 University of California campuses, building upon a sit-in at UC Berkeley's Wheeler Hall that began last week. In Berkeley, sign-toting and chanting students marched across Sproul Plaza down Bancroft Way to Berkeley High, a few blocks east of Berkeley City College, and finally back to campus to the chancellor's office where they gave impassioned speeches about the financial hardships they face. Students said they feared that college was increasingly become an option only for the wealthy and that the University of California was morphing into a private school. Some decried how far the university had strayed from the 1960 California Master Plan for Higher Education, which is intended to provide affordable college educations to every motivated student in California, regardless of income. And from what I understand, most people at this time, back in the 60s and 70s, attended college, the tuition was free.
Yeah, until Ronald Reagan was governor.
Okay.
And then he said he wasn't going to pay for the people who were protesting against him.
I see. Okay.
Well, but Reagan also did something that, from the standpoint of his fascistic mind, was probably brilliant. He figured that the way you end student demonstrations is that you raise the cost of tuition and you force students to have to work. And the idea was that then they wouldn't have enough time to be engaged in social change. And we see that that plan has moved from California all across the nation.
Indeed, yes.
Well, and also with the general trend of
corporatization of the university.
Yeah, and more or less privation of the middle.
Stagnation of wages and decline, absolutely.
Well, see, in the 1960s, it was plausible to have a TV show about a guy that just rode around on a motorcycle and did odd jobs called This Then Came Bronson.
Yeah.
You know,
because there were plenty of decent jobs.
Yeah, I mean,
at
you
time.
Could do that. You could live, basically, kind of live off the land.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
White men could.
Now that's, yeah, but it was, but you could, you know, students back then weren't so worried about, you know, at least white students, I'll put it like that, weren't so worried about getting the jobs and having the careers and so on and so forth. And as we have seen, there are former terroristic bombers who are now university professors in Chicago and palling around with the president, you know, as Sarah Palin would say.
And this tuition tuition has just gone up exponentially, you know, that's beyond, right. I remember when I graduated high school in 1975, tuition at the University of Illinois was about $300 a semester.
Wow.
And when I went back to school when I was in my mid-20s, that would have been in the, you know, by the time I went to U of I, it was after I went to Parkland, it was about the mid-80s. Tuition at the U of I at that time was $800 a semester, which was still a working person could, like, for instance, I worked summers as a union carpenter, so I made decent money during the summer, and I could afford to the tuition.
Yeah. Even into the 80s when I went back to school. Mm-hmm. You know.
But now, I mean, what is it, about $5,000 a semester at the U of I for undergrads, roughly?
Yeah, it's got to be close to that. Yeah. Actually, probably more than that. Because I think once you, if you're staying in the dorms, I think you end up with a bill at the end of the year that's about $28,000.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah.
Well,
you know, it's astronomical.
Yeah.
Yeah, and apparently there's people that can afford this, but like these buildings I'm working on lately. I mean, this new apartment building in the fourth and Green Street. It's going to have to be really expensive because one thing is, it's like it sort of stops at the fifth floor, and then there's like an open party area. You see, that takes up at least one third of the square footage there.
Wow.
So there, and then the rest of it's going to be apartments going up, but it's like, you know, they're giving up that. I mean, that's, it's got like this giant concrete hot tub, and
wow,
it's amazing.
That's the student population that they're aiming for. They're aiming for elite national and international students.
Well, this is even several years ago. This is in the 90s. Me and Peter Miller, founder of this radio program.
Along with you, Bill.
Thank
back
you.
Back in 1995,
and, we had attended something at the Labor College, you know, and we were standing out on the steps, and we were kind of talking about this sort of thing, and I said, look, man, you know, because I was saying this is an elite university, you know, and it's not, you know, like the land grant workers kind of thing like it's supposed to be. And I said, let's just watch the next few cars coming down the street. And it's like, you know, Volvo, BMW, Mercedes, guy on Harley Davidson wearing leather Harley Davidson clothes, probably more expensive than the car I was driving at the time. You know, and he's like, wow.
Yeah, indeed. Okay, and now for a local story. The day after the announcement that no charges will be brought against the police officer that killed unarmed 18-year-old Mike Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, over 250 people took to the streets in Urbana, Illinois as part of a national call to action. A diverse group representing campus and community, black, white, and brown, young and old, chanted, sang, shared poetry, and marched in a circle of hope, quote-unquote, between the Champaign County Courthouse and the Sheriff's Office and the county jail. The killing of Mike Brown reminded many of the killing of unarmed 15-year-old Kewan Carrington, who was shot by Champaign police 5 years ago. No charges were brought against the officers in Champaign. Instead, Chief Finney, who an eyewitness claimed actually shot Kewan Carrington, went on to consult for police departments, for instance, in Bloomington Normal, or for higher pay, and also got a job over in Bloomington Normal. And Officer Norbitz, who was alleged to have shot Kewan, has received $423,697 from the city of Champaign. Mike Brown and Kewan Carrington's deaths are part of a pattern of daily killings of civilians by police. Black youth are 21 times more likely to be shot dead by police than white youth. Law enforcement killed black Americans at nearly the same rate at as Jim Crow era lynching, said event organizer Daniel Chenoweth. Gus Wood,
let me stop there for a second.
Yes.
Actually, police brutality kills black youth at a much higher rate than at the peak of lynching. In the peak years of lynching is 1892, 93, 94.
Okay.
In those years, lynching averaged 141 African Americans killed. That comes out to about every 60 hours.
Okay.
Every 28 hours, a police officer, security guard, which is usually an off-duty police officer, or white vigilante, kills a black person in this country today.
Yeah. What a... Wow, that's just tough. Quite a statistic there. Gus Wood, co-president of the Graduate Employees Organization, opened the event with a condemnation of the, quote, mock trial orchestrated by a local prosecutor who was cozy with local law enforcement that resulted in no charges against the Ferguson police officer. The crowd cheered as he said the people of Ferguson have the right to protest free from threats and intimidation by police and condemn the state of emergency imposed by Missouri Governor Nixon. The group then took to the streets, blocking Main Street and waving signs calling for an indictment and end of the killings. The rally was organized by Champaign-Urbana Citizens for Peace and Justice, known for its successful efforts to halt jail expansion, block acquisition of tasers by police, establish a civilian Police Review Board in Urbana, lower the cost of phone calls from jail, and recently organized to elect one of its founders, Carol Ammons, to state rep. I also have noticed that there's been a lot of protests nationwide, all over the country, and even in Europe there's been protests. And I saw actually, it was this morning. They were able to post a lot of stuff about some of these protests. I guess the Thanksgiving Day parade in New York City was interrupted, and Macy's in New York City was occupied briefly. And there were protests. A friend of mine in Oakland, California, I talked to him on Thanksgiving. He was at the protest in Oakland where they shut down the interstate for a while. And the biggest one and the most interesting one, I think, is this happened up the road from Ferguson in St. Louis at the Galleria Mall, where they basically, it was great photos. It was so many protesters there and so many people who were shopping and who worked in the stores who came out and started participating with the protests. The police didn't know what to do when they got there. So the stores started putting down their gates, their security gates, and they closed them all, you know. And there were some great photos on that one. But, you know, it's just too bad, such a tragedy, you know. You know what I'm saying is these good things that come out, you know, people getting together, organizing, and going out, and you know, it's just too bad. It seems like it always has to have some kind of horrible tragedy associated with it to spark this sort of thing. We're gonna take a quick music break, and we're going to be right back with Sundiata to talk a little bit more about the subject we left off with Gus Wood last week. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on Listener Support Community Radio Station WEFT in Champaign. Stay tuned.
Everybody flying them but a Negro like me, Uncle Sam says, your place is on the ground. When I fly my airplanes, don't want no Negro round. The same thing for the Navy when ships go to sea. All they got is a mess boy's job for me, Uncle Sam says. Keep on your apron, son. You know I ain't gonna let you shoot my big Navy gun. Got my long government letters, my time to go. When I got to the army, found the same old Jim Crow, Uncle Sam says. Two camps for black and white. But when trouble starts, we'll all be in that same big fight. I think democracy is fine. I mean democracy without the color line, Uncle Sam says. We'll live the American way. Let's get together and kill Jim Crow today.
Okay, we're back. That was Josh White from a recording from the early 1940s called Uncle Sam about discrimination in the U.S. military at the time. And I don't know, I just tried to find some music kind of appropriate to our topic today, and that was one of the older ones I dug up. But anyway, so Sundiata, let's start with where we left off with Gus Wood, and that is the... you know, the more you get into Reconstruction, that period, I mean, it's wow, it's vast. I mean, you know, we could talk about all sorts of segments about it, but, you know, he mentioned one thing that I thought was really fascinating was that sort of as a prelude to, as, you know, Reconstruction was right before it kind of began officially, I guess you could say, that there was huge general strikes of sorts, basically, on the plantations by the African slaves.
Well, when he's talking about that, he's talking about in the period of the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why the Union is able to win is that African Americans go on a general strike. They simply flee the plantations. And in doing so, they not only take labor, right, and create a situation where the cotton can't be produced, and the South was dependent on their relationship with Great Britain in terms of being able to market the cotton. That's a source of major income for them. But they are also taking away, because they were being used to help build trenches, mm-hmm, and for the Confederate Army, so they're also taking that away from the Army and shifting that kind of resource to the Union,
mm-hmm,
right? So that's one of the keys to the Union victory, and that's Du Bois's point about the general strike, that it has to be seen as a tactic of African-American workers, and that's the term that he uses, right, in discussing those people who were enslaved, that they are, in fact, workers,
yes,
and that this is a form of worker resistance.
Yes, and we talked about that as far as previously the Civil War, too, that, the, you know, talking about the various groups of workers in the United States, and, of course, the slaves of African descent were definitely a category of workers, you know, which is...
Not just a category of workers, the most important workers in the country, because when you think about the United States and this transition from agriculture to industrial economy, that's powered through the product that's produced by the labor of enslaved African people.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, by the time you get to 1850, right, by the time you get to 1850, about 60% of U.S. exports is slave-produced product.
Okay.
Okay. So the dominant part that fuels the economy is slave labor. And so, you know, we oftentimes forget that this is the critical element in U.S. capital formation is enslaved African American labor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he mentioned touching on that too is that when after Reconstruction began and there was the freedmen colonies of African American self government, that actually a lot of northern industrialists actually began behind the scenes starting to try to help put the southern aristocracy kind of back in power, but in a little different form. And he mentioned even armed violence against a lot of the leaders of some of these freedmen, self-governing areas, I guess, because some of them consisted of several towns, you know, many towns, actually. Did you want to touch on that a little bit? Because it sounds like this was pre-Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah, a couple of things real quick.
Yeah, take it wherever you want to go here, because,
you know, at the time, when we discuss these moments, right?
Yes.
So we would think of Reconstruction as a moment, and we'll think about what follows Reconstruction, its overthrow, and what we call in African-American history the nadir, or the lowest point, right? What makes these moments important is not just their historical significance,
mm-hmm,
but they actually mirror contemporary moment, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason why we call the civil rights and black power movements the second Reconstruction. And if you follow the logic, right, Reconstruction is overthrown, and that's what Gus is talking about, that, mm-hmm, it's overthrown by force. In a place like South Carolina, there's a former colonel, Confederate colonel, last name of Gary. He comes up with what he calls the shotgun policy. And it's the strategy for how the Bourbon class, the former slaveholders, will take back control of the South Carolina government in the 1876 election. And what the plan calls for is simply kill them.
Oh.
Right?
Simply
kill them.
Okay.
And so the overthrow of Reconstruction is an overthrow on the basis of violence. That's why you have Congress in 1870 and 1871, they passed two acts called the Force Acts, or Enforcement Acts, right? The second Force Act is literally called the Ku Klux Klan Act. And these both acts make it illegal to use bribery, coercion, physical intimidation, economic threat to deny a person the right to vote. The second one does also what the 1965 Voting Rights Act does, is that it brings it under federal jurisdiction.
Okay.
Right? And that's because of the extent to which they were killing black folk. There are stories of 200 African-American leaders being marched into swamps in places like Georgia and simply never to be seen again, right? And these things are not, what would you say, far-fetched. Mm-hmm. So when people say that there's probably 5,000 African-Americans that are killed as part of the overthrow of Reconstruction, this is before lynching becomes something that's targeted on African-Americans. That's not an exaggeration.
Okay.
Not an exaggeration. And so we go from this moment, we compare Reconstruction to what we call the second Reconstruction, Civil Rights Black Power movements. Mm-hmm. And so when Reconstruction is overthrown, we get what's called the nadir, the abyss. And the key point about the nadir, right, is that, of course, you've got the installation of apartheid as the law of the land in Plessy v. Ferguson. You also have, and this is, you know, this will forever be a white mark on labor, that the first institutions to leave. Yeah, I thought y'all would catch up with that.
Yeah, so that's like the toilet calling the bathtub white.
So okay. The first organizations to exclude, draw the color line, were labor organizations. Because coming out of slavery in the urban areas, most of the carpenters, the caulkers, the skilled labor were former slaves, were freed people. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted to lock them out of the market. So you've got that, and you've got all of the discrimination and the rollback of the voting rights and all of those things. Mm-hmm. But the key, right, is, of course, continued labor exploitation by locking blacks into sharecropping and tenancy, but in order to maintain that system, right? Because, again, cotton export, agriculture export, is major in terms of the U.S. economy and remains major until the 1920s, right? So you got to lock black people into that category. But how do you keep them there? And you keep them there through force and violence. And that's why Rayford Logan, an African-American historian, called this period from 1877, after the negotiation to bring the troops out of the South, he called it the nadir, the worst of the worst. Well, what logic tells us, and what we also know if we study the history, this moment that comes after the end of civil rights and black power movements in the late 1970s, let's say the Bakke decision, we get a new nadir. And I say that in this sense, right? It's in 1990, that there are so many killings and assaults on African Americans that you get Congress passing the Hate Crimes Act. Which we have to understand that the Hate Crimes Act has the same kind of historical significance as the Force Acts of 1870, 1871, because it's speaking to the same thing, right? Unmitigated racial violence that has reached such a toll that we in Congress must take action,
mm-hmm.
Okay? And so if we understand that, and, you know, when you look at hate crimes, the most interesting thing is that, right, about 55% of all hate crimes are racially motivated, and about 70% of all racially motivated hate crimes are anti-black.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's the context in which we can talk about this link between these two moments. So when I talk about Reconstruction and its overthrow, talk about the nadir, I use it to draw the parallels to the contemporary moment, and that's where, you know, we can get students to understand its power. Because it helps shape and frame the moment that they actually live in.
Okay. Yeah. That's great analysis, and I love how you're tying that in. You know, I was always under the impression that a lot of this happened in the South, and Gus kind of enlightened us on this, that it was, yes, that, but more than this, yeah. In the sense that we always thought that the reason the troops, the federal troops were taken out of the South was because of the Great Uprising of 1876 and the increasing industrial strikes in the North. Gus mentioned, he goes, that was part of it, but more importantly, it was to try to reinstate the agricultural sector in the South. Yeah. And that was, as you described it so vividly, that's how they had to do it.
Yeah. That was actually the uprising of 1877.
77, thank you.
Which was caused by a panic or whatever at the time, and they were cutting wages.
In the midst
and so
of
on.
What they used to call depressions,
right.
Panics. Mm-hmm. So it's at the tail end of the panic of 1873 and 1877.
Right, okay, there you go.
Mm-hmm. That's where we first get the use of the concept hobo. Mm-hmm. That's when people would literally have to begin to take to the rails. And in some ways, right, Yeah, well, if not the recession, the depression of 1873 to 77, certainly the recession of 1893 to 97 is probably worse than what we call the Great Depression.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Okay. In sheer economic terms. Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
And then, you know, shortly after the Great Uprising of 1877, event about, you know, some 10 years later was the Haymarket riots. That's in right. Chicago, which is kind of where you started with your great analysis at the minimum wage, raise the minimum wage kind of that's event right. and everything, where I first heard you speak. So did you want to kind of talk a little about that period of time?
Well, that's part of the period that I'm calling the nadir.
Okay.
In terms of African American, we're working on two tracks, right?
Sure.
In other words, in African American history, we try and understand things from the standpoint of what happened to African Americans mm-hmm. and what African Americans did with what happened to them.
Okay.
So consequently, there will be historical eras mm-hmm. in which, in the African American context, we use one term.
Mm-hmm.
When we're speaking of U.S. history,
mm-hmm.
right, focus on the white majority, there's another concept.
Mm-hmm.
So this period that we're talking about, that you would see that as either the Gilded Age,
yeah.
or you see it as the Age of Industrialization, right?
Robber
but
Barons.
From African American, yeah. Well, the robber barons matter, but for African Americans, we call it the nadir. And it's not that, you know, the stark dissimilarities in wealth
mm-hmm.
Don't affect African Americans. It's not that the assault on labor. Right, because just as this is a period of intense anti-black violence, it is also a moment of intense, right, anti-labor violence.
Mm-hmm.
It's the moment in which the indigenous people finally are defeated militarily, right?
Yes.
Right, Wounded Knee, 1890.
Mm-hmm.
It's a moment of large-scale immigration coming into the country. And if we think about the Asian American component of that, it's in this moment that saying, you don't have a Chinaman's chance, becomes popular. And that is, of course, related to the reality in which that they use Chinese to take sticks of dynamite into the mines, and the wicks were set so short that they knew they couldn't make it out. And so that was the power in the slogan, you don't have a Chinaman's chance. So it is a moment of intense, you know, it's almost like primitive capital. You know how in this primitive stage, capital is very rapacious and just nasty and vicious. Well, in the industrialization in the U.S. takes us back to that moment when you think about the ways in which people were dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Whether we're talking about European, Southeastern European immigrants coming in, or we're talking about African Americans in the South, or we're talking about the incorporation of the Chicano people, we're talking about Asian immigrants coming in. Capital is mean,
yes,
and vicious. And so we end up with a series of labor organizing. And, you know, I'd say something about the Populist Party. One of the things that has happened in African American history is that there's been so much emphasis on the middle class that you forget, you know, that at any given moment, 92%, 93%, 94% of African Americans would be in the working class based on the type of occupations they've held,
mm-hmm.
right? And so, but if we think about that aspect as workers and what that meant, then when we look at this period, we have to you know, look and see what was the largest African American organization in this period, and it's the Colored Farmers Organization. They got 1.2 million members, and about half of them are women. A very
really?
Progressive,
yeah.
very progressive organization.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't find any. There's so little written on the Colored Farmers Association,
mm-hmm.
right? Very, very.
And these are independent farmers, correct? These aren't sharecroppers
no,
are included
also,
in this?
It also includes some farmhands.
Okay. So this is pretty inclusive, like yeah. Sort of like the Knights of Labor were.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
They're part of the populist movement.
Mm-hmm.
They're part of, so it's post-Knights of Labor. Yeah, it's the tail end of Knights of Labor.
Mm-hmm.
They're formed about 1886.
Okay.
But that organization is, of course, like they're linked to the populist movement, and they're fighting for essentially the same goals. It breaks down along race, but before that populist movement breaks down, there's a point where I'm trying to think of the leader of the Georgia Populist Party. Tom Watson. Tom Watson. There's a point where Tom Watson and the Populist Party in Georgia ride all night to stop the lynching of 40 or 50 African American leaders.
Oh wow!
So there's a moment where the populist movement is anti-racist.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, there's manipulation, and they play on their fears, Tom Watson flips into a demagogue, a racist demagogue, as does the populist movement. And all of these things are preparatory, of course, to Haymarket, as you say.
Yeah, and it seems like the ruling class in this country, going back to, a little after Jamestown, Howard Zinn documents, of course, a lot of the original plantation uprisings were a combination of African slaves and Irish indentured servants. So,
absolutely.
And that's shortly after, that's when they instituted the segregation laws. And it seems
not segregation laws.
Well, what I mean is separation.
No. People, you don't have what you want to use the term segregation. I want to use the term apartheid.
Okay.
You don't have apartheid in a residential sense, right, until the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s.
Okay.
Before that, you have class apartheid, right? But the working people, you'd have a street and there might be three black families in a house and their houses might be right there next to each other. Mm-hmm. But then you'd have seven or eight white homes. You might have an apartment building and all of the black people were in the basement and the whites were in the upper level, but they were in the same building. That's what, during the whole period of slavery, that's what it's like. It's once blacks are free, right, that you have to then begin to exclude, segregate in that way in order to reinforce, right, the power relationship.
Okay.
Right.
So as far as these rebellions, I mean, weren't there things that the ruling class did at that time to try to prevent the unity?
Absolutely. I mean, the best place probably to get this sense would be Edmund Morgan's, is it Edmund Morgan? The book, American Slavery, American Freedom. I think I've got the author wrong. American Slavery, American Freedom is a good place to see it. What they do is that, because the indentured servants and the Africans who have been enslaved often run off together and they rebel together, and it's Bacon's Rebellion that's the critical moment, Bacon's Rebellion of 1676, right? What happens is that they decide that rather than bring in African slaves who have been in the Caribbean and have acclimated to English culture, we'll bring them in directly from the continent. All of the things that were supposed to happen for indentured servants, you do your time, your 7 to 10 years, you're supposed to get $50, 50 acres. Well, they wasn't giving them the $50 and the 50 acres, and they were treating them miserably, right? They whipped them. They did all of the things that they did to African slaves. They said, well, we got to stop that, right? So they began to treat them better and treat the African, slavery becomes a condition tied to Africanity. Right? And so once you increase the cultural difference, you change the actual social conditions, right? So that these people no longer see themselves as occupying the same social place, right? Because if you run off with someone, if you're intermarrying, you have to have a sense of commonality. Mm-hmm. So they shatter that sense of commonality and exacerbate the difference, right? And that's, actually that's also the moment in which white is used as a designation for humans. Prior to that, in the Americas, right, they talked about nation and they talked about religion. So it was always a question of English Christians as opposed to African heathens or African Muslims, right, or indigenous. White comes in the 1680s.
The term white.
The term, as a popular designation for people of European descent.
Okay.
That's when they begin to draw that line. But it's wrong to think of it as segregation. It's racial oppression.
Mm-hmm.
Segregation, apartheid, is something very particular. It's a particular strategy.
Okay. Thank you for that correction. That's very informative and everything.
Actually, whiteness was really pretty much English. As, there's a famous book called How the Irish Became White. And, of course, Southern Europeans were a little swarthier, and, right. and Eastern Europeans.
Yeah, but there are no Southern and Eastern Europeans at this moment. Yeah. And while it is, the English are dominant, don't forget that, you know, as they make the point on the U.S. dollar with those little stars, that this is about the English, the Welsh, the Scots.
Right, that's what I mean.
They're linking the Northern Europeans as a common people.
Yeah.
Okay, and that's the work that whiteness does. Is that it obliterates nationality and ethnicity and ties them to a racial designation of superiority.
Yeah, and of course, those groups were never slaves either and actually had laws passed. It was more of an informal prejudice.
They were servants.
Yeah. Well, I was talking later on history.
Yeah.
And by the way, that book you mentioned, American Slavery, American Freedom, is by Edmund S. Morgan,
okay,
as
so
you thought,
right. yeah.
and it's available on Amazon for a pretty good price, too.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a quick music break here, and we're going to be right back, and it looks like we're going to might have a little bit of overtime today on the show because, wow, this is really getting into it, very, very interesting aspects of this period of history, which is pretty vast, and we'll see where else we could take this right after the music break. So stay tuned. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on listener-supported WFT Radio in Champaign, Illinois. We'll be right back.
Save the hammer for the man. Save the hammer for
Okay, we're back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour's Tom Morello, and it says, save the hammer for the man. Anyway, some quick public service announcements. This Saturday at 2 p.m. and every Saturday, another sports show with fellow worker Neil Parthen at WRFU 104.5, 2 to 3, talking about sort of a political and labor spin on the world of sports, basically. On Sunday, from 4 to 5 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6 or Urbana Public Television, is Labor's Worldview TV. So we're back.
Dave?
Yes.
Speaking of Urbana Public Television, if you go to YouTube and search for Ferguson Solidarity Rally Urbana, it will come up to the top of the screen, and then you could poke around on UPTV 6 and perhaps find Dave's show. Or I saw Dave Monk on there, mm-hmm. and then there's Carl Esterbrook with News from Neptune.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So we're back here with Professor Sundiata Chajua, and we were talking, well, it's a fascinating subject. You know, it's kind of started with Reconstruction, the Nadir, as he described it. I guess moving along, because we got some little ground to cover here, kind of we briefly referenced Haymarket, but then kind of moving along 1890s, the what they call the Great Panic, the Depression, which was you said worse even than the Depression of the 1930s. Yeah. So we move into the 19-teens, and we see some interesting things happening. I mean, of course, there's a huge more and more immigration from Europe, you see the formation. The Knights of Labor has ceased to exist, but you see a development of a new labor organization called the Industrial Workers of the World.
Right.
What's happening in both the North and the South with African-American workers at this point in time?
Well, the main thing here is that this is the moment that of the Great Migration.
So okay.
What we're talking about, this is still a nadir mm-hmm. in African American history. Nadir runs into the mid 20s, right?
Okay.
But this is the moment in which European immigration begins to slow and finally is cut off because of World War I.
Okay.
Now, what that means for African Americans is this: finally, there's options for them outside the South.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this is a period of the Great Migration, the first Great Migration. So you're going to get something like 700,000 African Americans net mm-hmm. leave the South, go to the North.
Okay.
And in that process, right, as a consequence, large numbers of the folks in the North, white folks in the North, don't want blacks coming in because they see them as the competition for jobs, right? And so there's a lot of stuff around blacks breaking strikes.
Mm-hmm.
You take what job you can get, and oftentimes people didn't know that they were being brought in to break a strike.
Like the meatpackers strike in Chicago right. in the teens, yes.
Other times, mm-hmm. People had a sense, but they needed work and they needed to get out of the South. But at any rate, rather than solidarity get built, we often ended up in situations of conflict
mm-hmm.
and competition in the jobs. So one of the major consequences of that is, of course, the urban race riots of the 19-teens and the 1920s. These race riots go back to the 1830s. But the period in which the race riot matters in American history is, of course, the 19-teens and the 1920s Great Migration. Now, I'm being very specific with my language here.
Okay.
Okay? A race riot is not what happened in Ferguson. Okay? A race riot is not what happened in the 1960s. Those were urban rebellions.
Mm-hmm.
A race riot is a situation in which we have private citizens, right, of black and white largely, who have a confrontation, right? Most often, it's whites coming into the black section of the community and pillaging and plundering, or it's whites running black people out of the public space, right? Whether it's Belle Island in Detroit or whether it's the beach in Chicago in 1919. And so it's usually white-initiated violence against an African-American community, and blacks fight back. The state, in the form of the police, in the form of the National Guard, for the military, often is brought in, i.e., to stop the violence.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, right, they act as if they are a component of the private white citizens engaged in the violence. Mm-hmm.
One such incident happened.
That's a very different thing than the African-American community rising up against the occupying forces of the police in their communities and burning the property of predatory capital in their communities.
Okay.
I know that's hard for people to hear.
Yeah.
But just look at the dynamics.
Mm-hmm.
You don't, in the 60s, not in Ferguson, you do not have black and white private citizens fighting. All of the violence is directed toward capital or directed toward the state in the form of its occupying forces.
Okay. And such an incident happened in Springfield, Illinois, didn't it?
Well, that's where I was going. You read my mind. Dave,
okay.
That Illinois, probably the two most important race riots in this period are Springfield 1908 and East St. Louis 1917.
Okay.
East St. Louis, because it's considered the worst race riot until, you know, for those people who want to think of Newark and Detroit as race riots, they say that East St. Louis was the worst race riot until that time. I would argue that East St. Louis stands as the worst race riot ever.
Okay.
Because of the number of people killed and because of the, you know, the whole politics of it. There are, you know, Du Bois wrote about it in The Crisis, and the NAACP argued that 175 African Americans were killed in the East St. Louis race riot. People closer to the ground estimate that it was 300. They say the Cahokia River ran red with the blood of black people.
What
in
usually
1917.
What sparked these, or I should say, what were the primary
labor
causes?
Conflict.
Labor conflicts, so labor competition conflict. For jobs.
Competition for jobs.
Okay.
Competition for jobs.
So we here, capitalism is again.
Which is very different, right?
Okay.
In all of these race riots, it becomes competition for jobs as dominant, but also struggle around public space.
Okay.
Right. So even though 1919 in Chicago, the spark. Right, the trigger incident is the young black boy who's on the inner tube, and you know we have these invisible lines of apartheid, and so he's floating out in the river, and his raft crosses the invisible line, and he's on the white side, and grown men start throwing bottles of beer, and they eventually hit him and knock him off the raft, and people believe he died. He actually didn't die, but that was the rumor, and then there's the clash. In the contemporary moment from the 1960s on, these urban rebellions are caused 95% of the time a police officer kills a young black person or a young Latino, and that sparks it. So you can see even the trigger incidents are different in these two phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
But East St. Louis, because of the magnitude and the viciousness, right?
Mm-hmm.
Springfield, 1908... because it leads directly to the formation of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP.
Mm-hmm.
But Illinois is a very, very interesting state. You know, if you look at the period from the Great Migration, actually even before the Great Migration, right, from, say, 1870 into 1940, at no point are African Americans more than 3% of the state's population. But African Americans make up 19 of the 34 people who are lynched in the state of Illinois, right? And the state of Illinois, along with Kansas, are the two northern states with the most lynchings, right? Further, the state of Illinois then has three major race riots.